All our history of broiling wars.
Welcome to Tell Me What to Think, a free and independent, no strings attached weekly podcast where we tell you what to think about politics, global affairs, current events, music, social media, culture, and anything else that bubbles up from the recesses of our minds. I'm Peter. You can contact me on Twitter at Floated Nemesis, and I have with me, as always and forever, Charles Minnick, who is on Twitter at Green Weird, which is green underscore weird. This episode, we have our segment Weak Thoughts, A Fall from Gucci Grace in the Coup in Zimbabwe, Twitterocracy, The Horrifying Genocide in Myanmar, or Burma, for those who have an old world map, and a review of Talib Kweli's new album Radio Silence in our hip-hop test drive. This is Tell Me What to Think. Ready, Charles?
Ready.
Time to get on our soap pod and tell you what to think.
Billions dead for damage, gold and cold sand. How do we measure our fellow man?
Hey, Charles, how you doing?
Good, Pete. How are you?
I am pretty good. Is there anything interesting from the week you noticed this past week? It's been an interesting week for more and more sexual assault accusers and very famous people, from Charlie Rose to, I saw, Jeffrey Tambor. It's always a roller coaster ride with this president, but I don't think anything we need to talk about. Is there anything that struck you as interesting from this week?
And one thing that's kind of gone under the radar, under a nearly party-line vote, Joseph Otting, the former regional head of One West Bank under Steve Mnuchin, has been confirmed as comptroller of the currency.
What does the comptroller of the currency do?
It's a little heralded position that has vast supervisory controls over banking. Like, they'll issue enforcement orders to go after banks, malfeasance, they issue orders of against individual tellers and people who have committed crimes at banks, ordering restitution necessary.
What is the federal government doing to individual tellers?
Well, if a teller takes tens of thousands of dollars out of a bank drawer, they will issue orders saying you're obviously no longer allowed to work in banking. But if they, I was reading the enforcement orders this morning, if, for instance, if you person takes money out of customer accounts, they're ordered to pay restitution to those customers.
So this seems troubling that this is
Yeah, almost all of the senior executives at One West are now in senior positions governing, you know, financial affairs in the government.
And that's where Mnuchin worked?
That's the company that he helped organize to buy up mortgages after the crisis.
Wow. Yeah, so that's, to be honest, not surprising.
Yeah, not surprising, given the current, shall we say, atmosphere.
Seems par for the course. Was there a, it was a party line vote. Were there any noteworthy?
Well, Joe Manchin continues to caucus with the Republicans, Democrat from West Virginia, to go along with it.
He's the one who has, like, coal industry ties, right?
Mm-hmm.
He didn't caucus with the Republicans on, or has he, on like the healthcare votes earlier this year?
Yeah, on most issues, he'll vote with the Republicans.
Really? But he's still registered Democrat.
Whatever that's worth.
Yeah, interesting. Are the parties kind of different, and is there a legacy there of being a little different in West Virginia? I mean, why is he? It doesn't seem like that would give you an advantage.
Well, it's one of the states that supported Donald Trump the most, so he's just appealing to his base. And in this case, he can help his special interest, too.
To me, that sounds like he's going to switch parties before he's up for election next time.
Almost certainly.
Unless he's jumps on whatever. Fair weather senator.
Right, or he's just entirely contemptuous of any political process.
So, last night I watched this documentary, Baltimore Rising, on HBO, about the aftermath of the Freddie Gray murder.
Uprising.
Everyone was let off, so I hesitate to say murder, but by police officers there. And it kind of went over, it didn't really go over the trials themselves, but the reaction to it, both through the police, but more importantly through community leaders. It was utterly fascinating. I would definitely recommend it to anyone. they had cameras in on a, just for example, on a meeting between the commissioner of police, who had just become commissioner, and some community leaders, and just seeing his reaction, their reactions. This one guy spoke up there who he seemed really uncomfortable even being in this meeting, because a number of them were like pastors, you know, religious leaders. And this guy, they didn't really explain how he got into the meeting. Following him through the story, and he works, he helps get people into drug treatment programs, and he's a former gang member. I believe his, he went by Shadow, is his name. And hearing him speak to the commissioner of police and being very blunt, was just fascinating. But then later on in the movie, he organized a flag football game between kids and average people, and then some police officers that the commissioner went to.
Yeah.
And it was just, it was fascinating. They went over some of the young members who were organizing the early Black Lives Matter movement in Baltimore. I definitely recommend it. It was actually directed by what's her name? Sonia, who played, she was from The Wire, played the lesbian cop.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, she is involved in Baltimore community organizing there now. But very cool, very behind the scenes. Highly recommend it. I think it's important to see. And by the way, it's very balanced. In the end, you don't necessarily come out saying that even Freddie Gray was murdered. But there's obviously an affinity by the filmmakers to the protests for him. And I think it's just because the filmmaker's taking a broader view that whether or not, however this specific instance ended up, there are bigger social problems here. And it was very mature, I would almost say, on the part of the filmmakers. It was balanced and was mature. There's also a reference to a murder police who was in it, and she actually did the investigation of his murder. And they talked to her, and she used to live in a house there. And she talks about how it was the Stanfields who were running drugs back then, and they used her house as a stash house. Her talking about how there were always these guns around, all these, she's like, every single one of them in that organization was a pedophile. Just heartbreaking.
Wow.
Yeah. And then the one more thing I'll say is that of all the depressing things in that, there's a character who was a colonel in the Baltimore police, older black gentleman. He was this director of like community outreach, community policing. He had a number of officers under him that were more like walk the beat type cops. Get out there, get to know members of the community, try and build trust for the police, or trust of the police. And at the end of the movie, during the credits, spoiler, they go through some of the main characters of the film and kind of tidbits of them afterwards, like you'd expect. And right. I think that the fact about him is that after the events of this movie, though not because of them, probably because of budgetary reasons, if anyone's seen The Wire, not surprising, it said his staff was cut by 80% and those officers were moved to other departments.
Wow.
He's still running it. He's still doing what he's doing. But just heart, when I saw that, I couldn't. I'm like, oh, why did that have to be how the movie ended? Like, because there were definitely things in it where you're thinking, this is hopeful. But that was not one of them. It was sad. Is there anything, I'm trying to think if there's anything political more this week. I think a lot of people in the country are looking forward to the Alabama Senate race, which we talked about last week. We don't need to get into the Roy Moore issue again.
Right.
But it's an interesting one. It will be important. It'll be probably after Thanksgiving break. The big, big news going around. There'll probably be poll reports every week about that.
Right. The story to expect, though, is obviously going to be the tax bill that's going through Congress.
Yeah, the tax, yeah.
Senate comes back. They're Has the Senate voted on it?
No, the Senate has not voted on it. Okay. The House passed theirs.
Right. So the Senate's going to have to vote on it, and then they're going to have to go to reconciliation or conference.
If they pass it, whereas it right now it seems like they might not have the vote. It seems like there's a little Republican resistance forming. I don't think he's come out. I don't think they've all come out explicitly against it, but Corker and Flake, our beloved Senator Ron Johnson, have either said that they are a no or they're leaning towards it, or they're... I actually saw an interesting thing that the reports that Flake, Corker, and Ron Johnson are kind of having these their own talks about ways to change it that would suit them. It's just interesting that there's a little Republican cabal forming.
Right. And you have Murkowski and McCain who voted against the health bill previously, so they'll have to be appeased, considering if they leave the mandate in.
Yeah, and Susan Collins as well.
Right.
Yeah, and then they have, yeah, this, they have their own group that seems to have these concerns about healthcare. And it's interesting that it seems like this mandate thing got added after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
After its initial...
Yeah, after the bill had already been announced and negotiated, they folded that in there and see if anyone would notice. And it's like, well, if you're willing to go along with this, how about if we throw the health mandate repeal in there? Huh? No? Bridge too far?
We'll yeah,
see in the next week.
Especially considering how contentious that has been and how much it's failed for them in these past 6 to 9 months, that they would, I assume McConnell and a couple of his cronies would have taken that risk. It just seems like there's that narrative that they're sneaking it in there, that they're trying to, you know, get it in quick, but they're not stupid. That was never going to happen.
I mean, maybe they're trying to sink their own tax bill. All the Republican donors are like, give me tax reform or don't call back. And, you know, they're looking at the tax reform that these donors want, and it's just terrible. Politically, economically, yeah, you could vote on that, or you could have a political career.
And it's my little conspiracy theory that they're trying to sink Trump. And I actually think a lot of these senators particularly are not up for re-election 2018. Right. And they're playing a little bit longer game here. It, by the way, terrible that they're willing to play this longer game with American lives at stake, American well-being, our prosperity. Mm-hmm. That they're fooling around. I mean, granted, I probably wouldn't like anything they do, but nonetheless, there are people out there who want them to do something, and I don't think they have any interest in allowing Trump to have a legislative victory. And I'm beginning to think that even McConnell is willing to take a loss in 2018, maybe impeach Trump, get him out of office, and then win the presidency in 2020. McConnell he's played games like this before. Not with impeachment necessarily, but he's done stuff like this. I think he knows he made a mistake. Never going to say it. Never going to tell us.
Of course not.
But it's just, I'm trying to put a reasoning into his behavior and into some of these people's behavior. And it's hard to come up with. It's like either just ineptitude, which I don't believe. I don't believe they're that inept.
Well, and McConnell's position in particular is even more sensitive considering his wife is transportation secretary.
Yes, he can't be terribly... He can't do what Corker and Flake are doing.
No, they can just walk away with their middle fingers raised.
Yeah, yeah.
Probably not in either case, literally, but...
I could maybe see Flake. I could see Flake flipping the bird.
He's... I thought he was incredibly religious, right?
Oh, is he? I don't. He probably is. Hey, I mean, we elected a reality TV star for president, and we're getting all these people fighting like reality people, like reality right? show stars.
He's going to fall out next week. Like Kushner?
Well, okay, so we're going to look forward to the tax bill or, you know, dread it night and day.
Well, expect it. Whatever, however you feel about it, expect it to happen or not. Oh, one thing I'd like to mention is that Lebanon, that's one thing to look for in the next week or so.
And this plays a little bit off of our talk last week about Yemen.
Mm-hmm. Right, so Saad Hariri is in France, I believe, right now, and he's going to be going to Egypt in the next few days to meet with President Sisi there. They had an Arab League meeting in Cairo this past weekend where they went around the room and talked about how much they hate Iran so much, and I assume discussed either, probably not in public session, but privately, what they're going to do about Lebanon, as Saudi Arabia is really trying to turn a temperature on that whole situation. And with Israel like openly announcing strategic cooperation with, or their willingness to cooperate strategically with Saudi Arabia, that situation could blow up violently very quickly.
I missed who were in these meetings. It was
in the Arab League. Lebanon didn't send their foreign minister ambassador. They sent their ambassador to the Arab League. And I think it was foreign ministers from Bahrain and the other major countries in the Saudi-led coalition.
Because it seems like Israel's going to have a say in this one way or another if it's involving Lebanon.
Mm-hmm.
But there's some reason to believe that Netanyahu is somehow complicit a little bit with these Saudi Arabian actions lately?
Well, there's been a burgeoning coalition of Israel and the, shall we say, Sunni Islamic nations like Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Bahrain. But the problem is that in 2002, the Arab League issued a peace proposal to Israel that said that they recognized the State of Israel within 1967 boundaries, they would basically open up relations. And it looks like they're opening relations without establishing any Palestinian state or, shall we say, long-term solution to the occupation. Could put them in a difficult situation politically if they choose to go forward on with Lebanon with, you know, Israeli support.
So, tell me what to think here. Is this the fucked up version of Kush and Trump bringing peace to the Middle East? Is that what this is?
Sort of. It's, they want a win. Like, Palestinian-Israeli situation has been going on since the 40s, and nobody all the way back to Bill Clinton has done anything more than put recommendations on the table while Israel puts up a separation wall, continues to expand their settlements in Palestinian what should be 1967 lines in the West Bank. But another part of this is that they're also supporting under Trump is going to be a very large or even bigger client state than it already has been, Saudi Arabia. Because America becomes a net energy exporter, have to encourage a new reason for the Saudi Arabians to have any interest in good relations with the United States. And right now, that relationship is we sell guns and bombs to them and continue to provide aerial refueling and intelligence for their operation in Lebanon.
Yeah, that's it right there. I think that's it right there. It's a perverted form of...
And in Trump fashion, they get to outsource some of their foreign policy and take it off of their ledgers, in some way continuing our policemen in the region policy in the Middle East, but, you know, it's really outsourcing some of the enforcement actions.
Well, there's something to be said for not policing the world, but...
There's something to be said for not supporting people. Okay, so even if you are a Trump supporter, even if you do agree with the reasons that Saudi Arabia is taking a more active foreign policy in the region, their lack of success, particularly in enforcing their will upon other countries, is, I would say, they have no successes. Like, the war in Yemen is going on for 2 years now, and without any resolution in sight. The Houthi-led government still controls the north of the country. They still control Sana'a, the capital. Qatar, for the past 6 months, they've been imposing an embargo upon Qatar, and they haven't budged. And the worst part is the Qataris are notionally willing to begin negotiations, which Rex Tillerson, to his credit, has been active in trying to facilitate. But the Saudi-led coalition is simply unwilling to negotiate Qataris on their team demands. So, yeah, even if you do like Saudi Arabia and think the reasons they're doing it is great, their lack of success should make anybody hesitant to support them going forward, especially if they want to start another war in a much more, shall we say, strategically important country.
But being concerned with someone's ability to do things well is not really a concern of a Trump supporter, let's be honest. As long as Saudi Arabia is telling us they're doing it well, we'll believe them.
All right, we have their word. I mean, they gave Kushner probably nice gifts. And there was that shared moment around the creepy glowing orb with
all the dictators. That's going to be on the cover of a history book someday.
Yeah, absolutely should be.
That's like that picture of Stalin, FDR, and Churchill
at the altar.
Yeah, that's going to be our generation's fucked up version of this.
Man.
Yep, the opposite of the greatest generation, I think. Unfortunately, although it is an old. I mean, these are all old. I mean, I guess FDR and them were old people at, you know, in the 40s. It's not like they were the 20-year-olds running the world, but yeah, that's going to be giving kids nightmares in the future. All right. Well, that was a weak thoughts, and let's get into a deep dive. We'll be back with talk on Zimbabwe.
Well, Enterprise, you go to make some allowance for a start for some form of Enterprise.
Looking ahead, do you believe that Rhodesian majority rule involves free elections at some point?
Yes, of course, why not? We are fighting for democracy. We would like to see a democratic state established in Zimbabwe. And this means a state based on the wishes of the majority of the people. The best way in which people can demonstrate their participation in democracy is by voting. And elections are quite a necessity.
What role do you see for yourself in the future Zimbabwe?
Well, for myself, I see a role assigned to me by my people, by my party, first and foremost. Whatever my party asks me to do, I shall do.
All right, about a week ago, there was a coup in Zimbabwe, military coup, at first it seemed like to replace Mugabe, and then that didn't happen. The reports coming out early on were that the military was unhappy with the potential successor to Robert Mugabe being his wife, Grace Mugabe. And it seemed to be a coup to implant the former vice president, who was out of the country at the time. So, Charles, could you give us a little summary of what happened? Tell us about the breaking news that occurred just a few moments ago, as far as we know, here in America. And then tell me what to think about it.
Okay. Well, in summary, about 2 weeks ago, Emmerson Mnangagwa was Minister of Defense. And then he was fired from his position by Grace Mugabe, one of the heirs apparent in the opaque Zimbabwe political structure. About 24 to 48 hours after that, he read a letter aloud to the top brass of the Ministry of Defense, and over the following weekend, the military took steps to take over. They deployed troops in Zimbabwe, in Harare, the capital, and rounded up the leaders of the G40 clique, which is a youth wing and a party of octogenarians. Like when Mnangagwa is in his 70s, Mugabe himself is 93. So they placed Mugabe under house arrest and asked him to resign. Thing is, like last Friday, he actually emceed a graduation ceremony at the local university. And apparently he read a different speech than the military had cared for him, so that they were placed in the difficult and probably embarrassing position of changing the speeches while the cameras were on them. Yeah, as I said, Mugabe was supposed to resign, and in the past, well, at first he was entirely reticent, like refused to go along, and then, like, just in the past hour or so, been announced that he, in fact, did resign after the parliament had started impeachment proceedings. So the one thing about this coup to remember is that this is not a revolutionary coup, like you see in the Arab Spring, for instance. This isn't a change of government to something new. This is, as Mnangagwa himself said, him correcting the line, which you have to understand, he apparently trained in China, mainland China in the 1960s. So he's used to having a very strong ideological line like that. And Grace Mugabe, who's otherwise known as Gucci Grace, was seen as a bit of a kleptocrat and directly impeded the, shall we say, continuation of that line, because if she took over, they didn't have the respect for apparently the revolution and the military traditions that the old guard had.
How do you pronounce this name? Is this the Mnangagwa general?
Yeah. Mnangagwa? No, he's the former vice president.
Oh, Mnangagwa is the former vice president. He is in the country now.
I think so.
I think so as well.
The reporting that I've seen is that he's been in South Africa, but I assume that he's probably on his way there if he isn't there already.
He's speaking to the media, though.
Yes.
Yeah. This seems to be more of a, almost like a peer, and I kind of hesitate to use this word, but purifying, at least in the eyes of the people performing the coup. They aren't changing the party, much less changing the form of government.
No, absolutely not. For the Zimbabwean people, though, it's just easy to support this because Mugabe has like left their country destitute and isolated from the international community, which is a shame because it was once a resource center in the breadbasket of southern Africa.
Has Robert Mugabe had a dereliction of duty now for his entire time in office, or has this been a more recent phenomenon as he's gotten older, maybe more complacent?
Well, the last round of inflation in 2008 finally got, after they had a brief coalition government and earlier in this decade, they managed to finally stabilize the currency, but they kicked out the MDC, the Movement for Democratic Change, in 2013. And have since, like Grace's and the G40, have taken a more active role in ensuring their ascent to power, which has been so interrupted. But they've been the ones benefiting from it rather than the people.
And what was the Movement for Democratic Change?
It's the opposition party. There's only two major parties in Zimbabwe, the ZANU-PF, which is the original Old Guard Revolutionary Party, and the Movement for Democratic Change. Morgan Tsvangirai has been a, shall we say, loyal opposition
and
his entire career.
And the MDC is effectively not operational then the past few years, or at least officially.
I mean, they haven't been outright banned, but especially in the last couple of elections, Grace Mugabe used the youth wing to say the least, election fraud, if not atrocities, to ensure her power.
So I find it interesting that this youth wing would be supporting a kleptocratic wing of the government rather than being dissatisfied. I mean, you know, often in politics and around the world and in history, change is brought about by the young folk. And this seems to be an example of the young folk supporting a portion of the old folk. And so the MDC, did they have a youth component too? Or is that just longtime older rivals of the...
Well, because of the lack of political plurality, both parties have, you know, of course, their youth wings and... Yeah, well, notionally would be the middle-income folk and the old guard, but as I said, the MDC has just kind of been stepped on by the ruling party, especially in the past decade after their coalition government broke down. Between poor reporting, I just don't think we're getting a proper look at or understanding of what the people there are necessarily feeling about this, because this is, on its face, just a convergence of interests. Like, the people want to see Mugabe go, so they're willing to go along with this. But whether they're going to be happy with a continuation of government is a whole different question.
The reporting that I've seen seems to imply, though they don't outright say, that because there isn't violence and massive protests in the street, everyone seems fine with it.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, it's almost a little bit of a looking down on the country from the West to say, well, because they're not burning their city to the ground, they must all be happy. Whereas, I mean, you know, that's not how politics works. There's probably a lot of people that are dissatisfied, especially if these unemployment rates that I read are anywhere near true.
Oh, they are. Country's like half unemployed, yeah.
That's insane.
Millions of Zimbabweans like either live in South Africa for noted for continuous employment or go there for seasonal labor every year.
Oh, wow. So one of the things I have heard about this is that so you referenced that Zimbabwe was part of the breadbasket of Africa, and a lot of that agriculture was at its peak under the white-owned apartheid government of the past.
Mm-hmm. When it was still called Rhodesia.
Yes, exactly. And when Mugabe came to power, which isn't surprising that he took away control from a lot of the large white landowners.
Another part of the story, though, that we should look into. Hang on, go on.
Well, that he and his government took a lot of this land away and a lot of these holdings and gave it out to, you know, to black people, to Africans. And the problem was is that he did it he gave it to loyalists and supporters, and it really wasn't done in a way to give it to people who knew how to farm That's part of there was just like a fundamental almost lack of professionalism that helped lead to this. It seems right. Like though over a couple decades that should have come back. Is it just that this government isn't doing anything to try? I mean, or is there, I don't know what else it could be.
Well, the one thing to remember about that, you're talking about the, shall we say, agricultural reappropriations that the government undertook in the early 2000s. Mnangagwa was instrumental in that proceedings, organizing it and carrying it out. But they gave the land to, in large part, as political favors to secure their own interests in the light of the party. So, as you mentioned, very inept people are now in charge of very large like swaths of land without the knowledge and wherewithal to, you know, utilize it in any economic sense, utilize it in the same productivity that it was used under the British. But they're also under, shall we say, financial constraints, as their foreign exchange doesn't allow for the importation of fertilizer and other, you know, agricultural additives that the British would have been able to import in large quantity.
Oh, wow. Okay. So that kind of leads me to another question, which is, so they were seeing support from the British, I guess, and rightfully so, I guess, shunned that. I understand that the Chinese are fairly involved with the country now, and you alluded to some of their leadership training in China past. Mm-hmm. So how are the Chinese involved now? Are they supportive of the coup? Were they supportive of Mugabe? Are they...
Their foreign ministry released a boilerplate statement that, yes, we support the will of the Zimbabwean people. Respect. But they usually don't get directly involved in these kind of coups. So long as their interests aren't touched and there's, shall we say, a continuity of sorts, legal process, they'll basically go along with whatever the individual client states want to do politically, internally.
That's sort of a sound foreign policy stance, if not ideologically bent. It seems to allow continuation of alliances without creating new enemies unexpectedly.
Right. And I think the weekend before? I'll have to double check this, but I'm fairly certain that Mnangagwa went to Beijing at some point in this timeline. I think it may have been right like immediately after he was fired from his post.
I believe I heard that as well, and the narrative behind that was they were letting the Chinese know to get their, again, don't want to say blessing, because they don't...
No, he was, you know, providing that continuity that they would have looked for.
Exactly. And this guy, He's, what's his nickname? The Crocodile?
Right, and Shona.
He has a little bit of a checkered political past.
Well, he led a brigade to repress Mugabe's political enemies just after they took power in 1980, allegedly killing tens of thousands of...
So I want to have... So I have a couple more questions on this. One is, tie it back to kind of us in America. I've heard people call him he's a George Washington-like figure for them there. And you know, many countries that have had independence movements would have that George Washington-like figure. In America, we had the luxury of this guy not staying in power for 40 years.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, that didn't happen there. Unfortunately, I imagine that's tough for the average Zimbabwean, particularly older people who would have been alive for it. Although the younger people, I'm sure, have their conflicting notions of it. And this gets back to earlier, we're talking about what the average person thinks there about this, and you know, there doesn't seem to be a lot of good reporting on this. But is this something that do dictators, not dictators, but do what would be the right, actually, right? What would be the right word for it? He's a what's the word for a long time president who has a strict hold on power but does hold elections? That's still like a de facto dictator.
Basically, they've just always called these people dictators.
Okay, so. Is there a precedent for what to expect here going forward with a figure like that that's revered and rightfully so for some things, but then is also sort of politically reviled?
Well, I'm sure that's part of that negotiate or that very delicate discussion that was had with Robert Mugabe after, in the interim between him saying I'm not going to resign and you know him just now saying I'll resign. Is that they were probably laying it out. It's, you can be part of our continuing political glory, remembered for your role in freeing Zimbabwe, and we'll let you retire with most of what you have, or this will go in a very, very different way, and no one will ever want to speak your name without spitting.
Yeah, and you have to imagine, you put yourself in his place, a 93-year-old, with a legacy... both in the past and then one to look forward to in the future, because he's not going to live forever.
Mm.
Why not have your last few years, live in comfort, help transition the government? It's interesting that he'd even be unwilling to step down, because what more do you have to do at that age? It's just interesting getting into the head of a powerful, usually man, that they don't know anything but more, more, more.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's that fear, right? Once fear starts creeping in, you're worried about what you'll lose.
But I imagine, it seems from an outsider's perspective, it seems like this is going about as well as it could.
I mean,
there aren't war crimes, there aren't deaths right? in the street, there's not...
just soldiers at soldiers at checkpoints and freshly... pressed uniforms, but what to look forward to is that this is, again, correcting a line, and what's the barometer here is Grace Mugabe. Is it anything?
Yeah, let's get into her for a second. So maybe it wasn't even Robert Mugabe who didn't want to not hold on, who didn't want to, who was unwilling to leave the presidency. Maybe it was Grace that was unwilling to let him leave.
Right, or he was unwilling to separate his legacy from hers, which is almost what he's doing in resigning. Yeah, this coup is directly aimed at her and her political clique. They're rounding up like Jonathan Moyo and other prominent leaders of this G40 political clique. So to see what kind of coup it's going to be, or what kind of counter-revolution this is going to be, depend on how they treat her. So far, I haven't seen any pictures of her out in public. There's been no video, no media contact, but she's allegedly been in the state house with Mugabe under house arrest. How they treat her going forward, now that Mugabe is resigned, is again going to be the telling point. Are they going to make an example out of her and go after the rest of the G40 in more violent and more judicial way? Are they going to start buying back assets from people they perceive as corrupt and just depositing them into the state coffers? Are they going to redistribute land, old political line?
So to look forward on this, keep an eye on any reports about her, because there have been scant, many of them, beyond some articles kind of writing up what the reader should know about her past and her involvement in the government now.
And some more with salacious details.
Little Instagram posts by her sons and all of that. So look for information on her. If Robert stepped down today,
they'll probably have to form a government in the next week or so. See, it'll be interesting to see who gets which seat.
Well, and the fact that they would be forming a government instead of maintaining the military.
I was going to say, other military coups, they just establish usually a ruling council of generals, and that eventually transitions into a government like in Thailand.
Well, like in Vietnam during the war, it's just one general after another being a military dictator.
Yeah,
they cycled through them. So it looks like this coup has been bloodless, has been quick, has been aimed at the right places. And hopefully the question going forward in the long term is whether the Zimbabweans themselves, which is the most important issue, constituency in this coup, make sure that they are all right. Hopefully they have many years of peace and maybe further prosperity. It's hard to say, though, with the same political party maintaining power. Maybe this is more of a reality show clash of personalities, or is this a clash of governing styles?
Well, we'll see what happens. They said they promised elections.
Yes, 2018 elections. I'm sure everyone in America will be paying attention to those elections.
What am I going to be using my profile for? What am I going to be sharing? What do I want out of Twitter? So you want to set some goals.
Are you just generally confused about Twitter? What's a tweet?
To be short, sweet, and to the point. It's a very fast-moving social media platform, so you can post more than once a day.
Today I'm going to demystify Twitter. I know most of you have heard about Twitter, use Twitter, have definitely heard about hashtags. So today I'm going to explain all of that. Follow your friends, you can follow celebrities, you can follow pastors, you can follow banks, you can follow organizations, you can follow...
Alright, so now let's do a Twitterocracy segment. You had some thoughts, Charles, about pundits and their weekend activities?
So the one thing I've noticed being on Twitter for the last month or so that I have been is that the Twitter fights almost always erupt on the weekend. Like, for instance, Neera Tanden got into a Twitter fight this past weekend, and like Joy Reid the weekend before. It's, kind of telling it. I mean, I get that they're busy during the week, but when they have free time, they just seem to be getting into Twitter fights with people.
Well, they're human too.
Fair enough.
Who did you see fight this weekend?
Neera Tanden is one I.
Who's that?
I don't follow her, but she's head of the name of it, one of the prominent Democratic think tanks in Washington.
Oh, okay.
A longtime Clinton supporter.
Who is she fighting?
She's Center for American Progress. Oh, just the further left-wing progressives on Twitter.
Oh.
It was against The Intercept. That's right. That was the original Twitter fight that I saw. She was going after Ryan Grimm and asking if they would put a new preface to all of their reporting on the WikiLeaks emails that said that this was all part of a Russian psyop. And then I think it was Glenn Greenwald or anything, someone associated with The Intercept responded that of The Intercept and the Center for American Progress, one of these companies takes money from foreign sources and it's not The Intercept or something to that effect.
Very cool.
Ryan Grimm, to his credit, was like, that's an interesting idea, but I'm not sure why we or how we would do it. And I guess they could write a script for it, but journalistically, I'm not sure. Like, Dan Frumkin, also the editor for The Intercept at the time, chimed in and said that, well, it stood by his reporting.
So the one thing I was going to bring up is, which apparently you're not familiar with, this, if you go on Twitter, there's something called hashtag Team Patriot. And Team Patriot is this meme, I guess you could say. It's this group created by a writer named Luis Mensch, and the other one I think is named Claude Taylor. Claude Taylor has some, I don't know, expansive bio of him, but he's worked in White Houses, I guess. Longtime political operative. I don't know much about him. Luis Mensch is
a member of parliament. Wow.
Yes, she was a brief member of parliament. She is, I guess, she's a conservative. She is believed by many people on Twitter to be a member of the alt-right. And she apparently has tweeted pro-Trump things in the past. Well, at some point in the past year, year and a half, she started becoming very anti-Trump. And they created this thing, Team Patriot. And before I got on Twitter, I saw people reference her a lot as someone who, on one hand, breaks stories about, say, the Russia investigation way before anyone else. On the other hand, I've seen her called a kookbag who makes up bullshit all the time. And so when I got on Twitter, I at some point saw her link. I'm like, oh, I know that name. So I started looking into it a little bit. She at one point said that there were indictments on everyone, including Trump, and that, what was the one thing she said? That, like, Chief Justice John Roberts was running some sort of grand jury or something already. And it's pretty explosive stuff. Well, this past week, there might be some evidence as to what their game is. And the main person I see tweet these things is someone at Nadine, it's NadineVeldE. I don't think I follow them, but I think people retweet this person a lot. And she is constantly tweeting about them and how they're a bunch of frauds. Well, this past week, someone had a big long thread about how you could subscribe to this block list. They created their own block list. And the idea was that it was going to block it's named Chief Kafefe put together the blacklist, and it was supposed to block, they said, like anti-resistance trolls and Russian trolls and stuff like that. So you wouldn't ever even see them. Well, what this person, here's the person who broke it. Someone, Northern Resistance at MC Jeffrey. And this person claimed that, so they joined the block list, and then they're noticing something weird. They weren't seeing an actual lot of resistance accounts. And they would go to, I guess, stuff in the real world and be like, hey, how come I never see your stuff on Twitter? And then be like, I don't know. I tweet all the time. And supposedly, this block list has like 100,000 resistance accounts. And the idea being that Luis Mensch and company are creating, they're quote unquote joining the resistance so as to delegitimize it, to make it seem crazy. And then they're actually creating a block list of resistance accounts so people aren't able to coordinate and communicate and see news stories and all that. And there's a lot of drama going on with it. There's a lot of accusations back and forth.
Some interesting social engineering, though.
Yeah, there's something going on somehow. I'm not 100% certain who's, you know, right here. But anytime I have been on this Luis Mensch's page, it is crazy town. It's for sure crazy town. So I tend to believe that she's not the... And I don't follow her, and nor would I.
Well, we've seen Twitter's platform just abused willy-nilly in the past, so it's not surprising that another group has found apparently a novel way of doing that.
Yeah, I don't think most people had even knew that there's a way to have a block list.
Yeah, I didn't realize like you could, was either. I mean, I knew that you could block people, but to have an entire list that you could subscribe to is interesting.
Yeah. As if you need it, too. Like, being on Twitter now for a few weeks, if there's something that... So I got followed by a couple weird people. I mean, in general, it's like someone wants to follow me if they... Like, I just got followed yesterday by someone who has, like, hashtag Trump, hashtag, you know, bullshit I don't like. But, you know, whatever. They want to follow me. Like, I'm not going to, you know, whatever. It's their right. And I should be able to follow them if I wanted to, which I'm not. But, but there were definitely a couple weird accounts that followed me that definitely rang some alarm bells. And I just... I don't know if I blocked them or ignored them or what the hell I did, but I didn't want anything to do with it. One of them like was all like weird clickbaity news articles about animals and gross surgeries and shit.
Weird.
And I'm like, okay, yeah, don't need that anywhere near me.
Sounds like bot behavior.
Yes, yeah, it seemed like, and I actually then did some like Google research. I'm like, because they linked to like a news site, and I'm like, what the hell is this? And I couldn't figure it out, so I'm like, nah, just get it out of here. Like, being on here, I have not felt that there are massive amounts of people I need to block. It's to me, that's unnecessary, and there has to be, honestly, to me, it seems like some sort of nefarious purpose, though again, I don't know the exact. And I don't want to speculate too much, but hey, go on Twitter and see all the speculation. It's fun,
right? I mean, if you think your ideas are so weak that they can't withstand whatever critique you may encounter or opposition to your ideas that, you know, you also support, but yeah, if you think your ideas are weak, then go ahead and block everybody. I think, but this block list kind of reinforces the point of the siloing, especially on Twitter, where it turns into, like, you know, the echo chambers where all you hear are the people that you want to hear.
Yeah. And you know what? To be honest, I've had two sort of arguments, I guess you could say, on Twitter. There's three. One was with some liberal lady who just totally blocked me. Just totally blocked me. For saying that she's a great person because she listens to conservatives, essentially. The other one I had was with I think it was in the same thread later on, with a conservative guy who we kind of argued for a bit and then kind of came to a mutual understanding. Like, we both stopped assuming the worst of the other person.
And we're willing to talk to each other.
Yeah, it was really refreshing. It was so, so refreshing. It's actually, it was great. It was great. Like, because I can get into arguments with conservatives, and it doesn't seem like you can get to that point a lot. But this was a really nice point. He's like, he started arguing with me. He's like, you say we're stupid. And I'm like, I don't say you're stupid. I don't even know you.
Right? I didn't start off with the ad hominem.
He's like, well, I mean, like, liberals. I'm like, okay, well... Fine, but let me just tell you
an identity.
Yeah, let me just tell you who I am for a second, and then we came to an understanding. And I was like, you know, that's great that you think this. And then he's like, you know, yeah, I shouldn't assume this about you. The third one I got into is just the other day, and we actually did kind of come to there was a little misunderstanding, but it was on. I can't remember the exact account. I think it's Joel Bernstein. I think it's just at Bernstein is his handle. And he is the author, the journalist who broke the McMaster calling Trump an idiot at a private dinner story, which, you know, I had read the story and he mentions in there, you know, there's, I had five anonymous sources who heard directly from someone at the dinner and they all confirmed and blah, blah, blah. And I didn't really think much of it. That's relatively common for these types of stories. It didn't really ring any alarm bells. Well, for whatever reason, I was reading, or I think I follow him actually. And I saw another post where he's like, I want to clarify my article. because some people are calling it out, which I had seen other journalists call out the article, being like, hey, is this real? Like, I don't really trust this. The sources don't seem right. It doesn't seem like something McMaster would do.
Right. He's a 3-star general. I mean, even if you're not a political animal, you play politics at that level.
But it being a private dinner, you know, maybe it's
I don't
possible.
Know.
But I agree. Skepticism was fine. I mean, I don't really have a problem with him doing the article or them calling out the article either way.
Sure.
But he made these posts where he's clarifying it. And I happened to see it right as it was. He wrote them and there weren't really any comments yet. And his clarification all of a sudden raised alarm bells for me. He's like, he's dancing around the idea that he has alt-right sources or people who may have anti-McMaster motivations. And he started defending, like, well, just to think that someone has, you know, bad motivations doesn't mean they don't have reliable information, which is true. But I'm like, well, wait, hold on, you're dancing around this. And so I made a comment like, hey, I don't really care either way. It's just that your clarification seems to actually raise more questions. So I asked, I had the first comment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I asked like, hey, are you implying that your sources are alt-right? It just seems like your clarification is raising a question.
Yeah,
it was raising a question that I never thought of beforehand. And he never responded, which was
worse.
Pretty disappointing to me, actually.
The Twitterocracy, like the elite, don't really, like, they choose who they fight with.
Yes. And to me, it was like I was giving him an opportunity to clarify something that he was, I think, attempting to do. But, sure. And I was like, hey, I know you can't out your sources and blah, blah, blah. Well, anyway, someone starts arguing with me and they're like, he never said that. He never said his sources were alt-right, and I'm like, okay, but if you actually read what he says, it kind of seems that way. And then he starts, like, saying, like, you're making all these assumptions, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, actually, asking a question is the opposite of a fucking assumption.
Right.
So, but yeah, it turns out he was sort of reacting to someone else who started chiming in the thread who was making all of these, like, he's just getting Steve Bannon as his source. And I'm like, you know, that guy's full of it. Like, you don't know his source. There really wasn't even enough in the article.
I'm trying to imagine the dinner where McMaster and Bannon would agree to sit down at the same table.
Well, so that's the thing. So so this was a meeting with Oracle and the CEO of Oracle.
Ah, okay. That makes more sense.
And Oracle, I guess, has strong ties to the administration. And the supposedly McMaster said to the CEO, you know, he called Trump stupid and an idiot. And by the way, this was in July, right around the same time that Tillerson is reported to have called Trump a fucking idiot. So,
man, I'm going to have to go back and look to see what they were calling him stupid for. It seems like if both people were doing it at the same time, it's got to be like one of his decisions, right, that they were both in the room for.
Well, interesting. Tillerson was saying it because of something to do with North Korea, I believe, was what that
McMaster, of course, would be in the room for that.
Yes, exactly. This one, though, didn't really get into why McMaster said it. It was just gossipy. I mean, honestly, in the end, it's just gossipy bullshit.
Right.
It's like, none of us think that McMaster thinks Trump is smart. I'm not making that assumption, nor should anyone else. Unless you just, you know, you view Trump as the God King. But I guess this Oracle dinner, 5 or 6 sources who claim to have gotten firsthand knowledge from the Oracle CEO all said that McMaster said this to her. The thing is that this Oracle apparently has strong ties to the Trump administration. And remember that guy who was kicked off the National Security Council? I believe it's when Kelly took over the chief of staff position, or maybe it was when McMaster took over national security advisor. But it's like Ezra something, Ezra Cohen, I believe. I could be getting that right name wrong, and if I am, I apologize to Ezra Cohen.
Ezra Cohen-Wetnick,
yeah,
former senior director for intelligence programs. Yep.
And that guy apparently now works for Oracle. And wow. So that, I think that's the evidence that they're basing, that there are people like him, like either he directly is the source or people like him. And those people have, yeah, I mean, the alt-right, Breitbart, they've been talking shit about McMaster for months now. So, you know, they're probably trying to get Trump riled up to fire McMaster. It is the narrative behind that, which may also be right. And maybe Bernstein is unwittingly being complicit in this.
That's the problem with reporting on hearsay, though. You're not really reporting it for a journalistic reason to like reveal some kind of truth with evidence. You're just reporting what somebody's saying, and so you're ultimately serving as a like an amplifier for what they want to accomplish.
Yeah, and I think maybe he's justifying it by saying that, well, it's important for the American people to know that people in the cabinet think Trump is also an idiot. Which, you know, hey, again, why would anyone assume otherwise?
Senior director for intelligence programs at 31. Wow.
Yeah, I think that was, I can't remember if it's McMaster or Kelly that kicked him off, but
yeah, I think like McMaster, when he came on, he got rid of a lot of the people that Flynn brought on.
Rightfully. I mean, totally should have done that.
I mean, how could you trust somebody that was appointed by an unregistered foreign agent?
And I'm sure he wanted no part of that.
No, any good American would have walked away from that.
Yeah. Even most bad Americans, honestly, probably would have too. All right, well, that's probably a good... That's enough Twitter for the time being.
Myanmar refugees spilling into China. China's aims to try to influence some of the ethnic clashes there. So what is it about the strategic relationship between the two?
Well, on the Myanmar side, Myanmar has been trying to, over the last 5 years, bring to an end this ethnic insurgency that has plagued its periphery for the last 70 years. And what they want from China is some assistance bringing those insurgencies to an end. Some of these ethnic groups are Han Chinese, and they receive support from within China and take shelter within China. And so Myanmar, in fact, there was even an instance recently in which one of these organizations was crowdfunding in China and using an online crowdfunding account. So Myanmar really wanted China to help them by shutting down some of these efforts and helping bring to heel some of these insurgency groups. And China now has an incentive to do that now that the pipeline is online. Because while these groups that they've supported haven't attacked the pipeline, they do supply groups that do.
Over the past, few months, there's been this trouble in Myanmar?
Right. The problem officially started on August 25th when some rebels in the Rakhine State attacked a bunch of army checkpoints and police checkpoints.
And it's now led to supposedly one of the worst ethnic cleansings.
I mean, I think we can polish off the supposedlies and allegedlies at this point.
It's led to one of the worst genocidal events we've seen in decades, or maybe since the 90s?
Yeah, at least in the past. I mean, with Yemen going on at the same time.
Sure.
It's tough to compare. I didn't realize that we would have to compare genocides for how objectively terrible they are.
And so this is I believe it's the military of Myanmar.
Mm-hmm.
And to Americans, you're obligated at this point to say, formerly known as Burma, to their military, which is overreacting to this population. So now what is this Muslim population? What are they known as?
The Rohingya Muslims.
They are in the north of the country. Is that correct?
The western part, Rakhine State. Yeah. The border of Bangladesh and India, which is where they're trying to flee towards. There's a lot of opportunism going on with this too. Myanmar has, of course, been wracked by inter-ethnic violence since almost its creation. This, in particular, the attacks seem to be, to me, to be a pretense for the ongoing ethnic cleansing. It's just a convenient excuse to do what they were going to do anyway.
Yeah, this doesn't seem to be like a police action going after some armed insurgency.
No, they're, because from the tactics that I've seen is that they're using locals who, you know, in these mixed villages out in the countryside, you might have 80% Buddhist, 20% Muslim, or vice versa. And so they're using, like, shall we say, vigilantes or extremists in the among the Buddhists to help them carry out, you know, these local campaigns.
That's horrific.
Yeah, so your neighbor will come to your house and steal all your belongings, probably rape the females, and burn your house to the ground with you and the people may or may not be in them.
Yeah, and that kind of explains why there seems to be an apocalyptic aspect to this, which is, you know, a lot of raping and pillaging.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't just the army coming in, rounding everyone out up and, you know, getting rid of them, either through death or it seems to be chaotic in its core. Politically there, what's going on? Why is the government, does the government just have an ideological problem with this? Is it religious? Is it?
There's an economic value here. The Chinese government is sponsoring the construction of a deep water port at the southern end of Rakhine State there, so that they can truck supplies and oil directly into mainland China without having to go through the Singapore Strait or the Strait of Malacca.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can imagine if they're going to try to build that infrastructure, they would want to, shall we say, maximize the value of transfer for when they have to start buying up property and moving equipment into the area. They want to make sure that the right people get that money. And so they're pushing out the Rohingya Muslims, which, as an aside, Myanmar is a very ethnocentric state. And that's part of the large reason that they have such inter-ethnic violence and, shall we say, a tight mosaic of ethnicities and religions that's been created by thousands of years of human migration. They are fanatically Buddhist. And, for instance, the Rohingya Muslims don't actually have citizenship to the country, as they are known as Bengalis. So they are effectively stateless. They're pushing them out of the country.
Ooh.
And there is another aspect. I'm sure some of our viewers may or may not have heard that they're going to try to repatriate these refugees, but they're imposing terrible requirements in terms of paperwork. Like, they have to prove their citizenship and they have to prove their family has been in the country since the British first arrived in Myanmar or in Burma and made it and called it Burma.
Wow.
So these people will probably never be repatriated in any meaningful way, but the Bangladeshi government and the Indian government even more so is not willing to welcome this overwhelmingly desperate and poor population of refugees into their country.
Which, I mean, it'd be great if they did, but, you know, you can kind of understand another country. Every country has their own problems. Mm-hmm. That's really, so why did they never have citizens? I mean, I guess there's a religious, ethnic
mm-hmm.
reason, but I mean, they've been stateless for generations then.
Centuries, yeah. Since at least the creation of Myanmar in 1960. But the initial founder of Myanmar, Aung San Suu Kyi's father, was going to be a much more inclusive, multicultural kind of society before, you know, he was assassinated in the military coup. And, you know, of course, they laud Aung San Suu Kyi in perhaps a mistaken notion that she agreed with her father. She was highly educated at Oxford and, of course, speaks English.
Okay.
And was that alone would have been reason enough for the military to impose that long house arrest, because unlike most of the people that they were inflicting violence and deprivation on, she could speak the language that, you know, ordinary, I guess for lack of a better word, white Westerners could listen to and understand, and, you know, who actually perhaps willing to listen to. she had a much more an easier platform in Western media than, you know, as I said, the other victims of the repression.
Was she supported by the West?
Of course, she's always been supported by West. By the West, Obama visited her specifically when he went to Myanmar. And yeah, because she has been under house arrest, they've held her treatment. I'll say when they released her from house arrest and allowed her to take a position in the government, most Western governments were willing to go along with the fact that the government is still mostly controlled by the same military that they were harping on just like times and months before.
Yeah, I understand that it's something like 20% of their parliament are seats chosen by the military.
Up to a third. Wow. Like they have like substantial control. And of course, they basically appoint the president and prime minister. Aung San Suu Kyi herself is just counselor because she can't be president because in their constitution, they made a specific law where if you're married to a foreigner, you can't become president.
So do they not have one or?
No, they have one, but
oh,
it's just not her, as most Western governments and the people would have expected.
I guess I'm not quite understanding. So,
to my estimation, they're co-opting her legitimacy.
Huh. Wow.
I mean, she's had a press conference of the Rohingya area, and at times, like, they seem to talk to people on the side of the road, like common people, but it was basically a press operation.
So I understand that the Myanmar government is a little bit playing off the West and China to suit their interests. I mean, it seems like there's no way that the Chinese are going to let some sort of big UN force go in there.
Absolutely not. Not if they want to develop the area economically in the near term.
But could it spiral into something worse?
I mean,
if that doesn't happen, well, not worse for the Rohingya, but I guess there's no one backing these people, so it's not like it's going to break out into war.
No, unfortunately not. Well, I mean, not fortunately, but yeah, there's no substantial support for the Rohingya Muslims other than perhaps charity and support through the UN refugee agencies and relevant agencies. But this story has been long in the coming because even in 2 years ago when the New York Times reported their huge story detailing human smuggling basically in Asia, a lot of the people who are being smuggled to work as slave labor in the palm plantations in Malaysia and Indonesia were Rohingya Muslim trying to escape this violence even then.
Wow. Yeah, this is it's pretty horrific. About how many people? Is this a million, a couple million, or is it bigger?
I think right now there's hundreds of thousands of people who have fled into Bangladesh and India. India is much less welcoming to the refugees than Bangladesh. So,
is that for ethnic?
Mostly going there.
Is that for religious reasons there? Or?
They just don't want to take the people because, you know, if they have the people in their borders, then they're their problem.
The one thing
we not to deal with it.
The one thing we don't need is more people.
More problems.
Yeah.
You know, the Indian government being Hindu is trying to maintain. Indian Myanmar has had a long-term detente where they keep their problems on their respective sides of the fence. And just try to develop commercial ties.
I feel like this comes up a lot in our conversations, but tell me what to think. Is there any hope?
There's attention being drawn to the situation. Hopefully other leading Muslim nations will take a more active stance. I'm sure that it was brought up in last week's ASEAN conference, which I don't think they released a closing statement for.
Okay.
It's not going to escalate, especially, if the weather turns. The campaign will have, you know, some impediments to it. There's that. But the Bengali government, or the Bangladeshi government, is more, they want to end the situation too, so they're eager to start repatriation, which I don't even know what that would look like. Imposing those kind of entry requirements there's no good solution there. Those people are going to get caught in the middle.
So is the entire population now displaced?
I think it's still ongoing.
Wow. So there could be even more people added to this.
Right. The situation could get much worse, especially if they expand it beyond the Rohingya Muslims and include other ethnicities.
Oh,
like I heard there have been some Hindu people displaced too.
Oh, wow. Wow. I mean, so you're proposing that this is to get their land.
Mm-hmm. Control the resources and get rid of the population that isn't even objectively recognized, like not even respected, but just recognized by the central government.
Yeah. Well, it's something definitely to keep an eye on for any
developments.
Yeah, and anyone who cares about humanitarian causes and problems in the world. Well, that was one of our more depressing talks. That one's not good.
Yeah, so what's the hope? I mean, I guess it could be worse. They could be displacing more people.
Take it to the top. Yeah. That's where we at with it. Take it to the top. Just because you are a character don't mean you have character.
Get in the car, light up a blunt, turn up the bass, right, and let's go on a Pete and Charles hip-hop test drive. Talib Kweli released Radio Silence this past week. Longtime MC. He's been around forever. What'd you think of it?
I thought it was a pretty good album. He's got some really good guest spots. The one thing that I thought was strange is that the title track, Radio Silence, was a guest track instead of one of the usual solo tracks that hip-hoppers or rap artists would typically name their albums off of. But it's an interesting choice. Personally, I didn't think that was the strongest track on the album.
Yeah, I agree. Which one did you like best? Do you remember?
I thought She's My Hero was the highlight of the album.
I totally agree. That is that's exactly what I was thinking. That is like conscious rap at its best right there.
Absolutely.
That has a message. It's lyrically just great. Really vivid. Felt like you know, it's like if you don't like tear up, then you're not human. I totally agree. I thought the beat on Chips, which is the next song with Waka Flocka, was great. I like Talib Kweli's verse on it. Waka Flocka is garbage as far as I'm concerned, though. He just, like, as soon as he comes in, the song just, like, takes a, you know, dive.
Right, he announces himself by typing on his name, Waka, Waka, Waka.
Yeah, it's just... Mm. I thought the opening track was really cool. What's it called? The Magic Hour.
I thought song to start the album.
Yeah, exactly. I thought his lyrical skills on that. He's excellent at the multi-syllabic end rhyme. Just one after another. Reminds me of Immortal Technique, but a little bit faster.
Mm-hmm. A little bit.
He had a Game of Thrones reference in there, talking about how to raise a dragon in High Valyrian. I loved that. I thought the low point of the album was probably The One I Love. Kind of like one of these rap love songs. It's like, you're the only one for me. It's like, I've heard that a million times, and I just never buy it, to be honest.
That always sounds like a sales pitch.
Yeah, it's like...
I gotta say, Rick Ross's verse is perhaps one of the best on the album, though.
Rick Ross is he's pretty great. I thought it was a good album as a whole. It's definitely not, you know, as someone who's been into hip-hop for a long time, I like it and I'm fine with it, but it's definitely not something I would hand to a 17-year-old and be like, oh, this is hot. Like, it just, the music, musically, it just isn't, it doesn't sound fresh. It doesn't sound like what the kids are doing. And that's, you know, that's a good or bad thing, kind of depending on your perspective, or neither. But he definitely wasn't getting in, like, I mean, I don't know who produced the album, but it didn't seem like it was producers who were doing modern sounding beats. It didn't sound like a Kendrick track or a new Kanye track or anything like that. But it was good. I mean, it sounded like something like, it almost sounded, the music kind of reminded me of almost like if the Roots were the backup band for it, like just a tight funk band was playing, and which is cool. I mean, it was, I loved it. It was really good. I don't know if, I just don't know if the kids would like it, so to speak. I also thought the track All of Us was really great. I think that's the one that starts with, it looked like a recording from like a protest. Mm-hmm. It sounded like, I thought that was another just top notch conscious rap track. It had a political perspective. It had some hope to it. Yeah, it just seemed like a protest song. And that was, I thought that was really great. Any other thoughts on the album? Any other thoughts on Talib Kweli in general about his?
Well, it's, as you kind of pointed out, it's kind of tough to find anything to say about it because it's not particularly innovative. I mean,
totally agree.
It's Talib Kweli style over new beats, and the album is what, now that I look at it, more than half guest spots. So
yeah, no, it seems like one of those projects that's, this is what I do. It's no reinventing, but if you're a Talib Kweli fan,
it's
that's
totally
great.
Up your alley. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Great. Yeah. It's, I guess, yeah, if we were doing like a recommendation, like a buy it or buy it. I would say if you're a Talib Kweli fan, buy it for sure. It's exactly what you want and expect. If you only know him from guest spots on Dave Chappelle 10, 15 years ago, you'll like it because that's just what he's like.
Consistent.
Yeah, but it's not going to, it's not a reinvention or anything like that.
Right, it's not quality or eardrum.
All right, well, that was the hip-hop test drive. Put out that blunt. We have to go back inside. We heard the new track. All right, so is there anything else you wanted to bring up? Any other little issues from the week or anything to look forward to?
Well, one issue that's been developing over the past week is Turkey's economy is, well, outwardly showing signs of strain. The Turkish lira is at near historic lows against the dollar, the euro, and the Russian ruble. And their stock market is, well, I guess in the past day there's been a 1% correction, but in the past week or so has been going down by multiple percentage points per day. So look at that situation as it develops. Will Erdogan be able to successfully manage this ideological government that he's trying to, you know, bring about? Because if it doesn't deliver economic prosperity, it may encounter some traffic bumps. The lower Turkish lira suggests that there could be massive inflows of investment. Under the favorable rate, but if there isn't that kind of investment, then we'll see even wilder economic fluctuations.
Do they have much manufacturing there? Could that boost that for them?
Well, that's what they've been trying to bet on. They've been becoming a new source for outsourced labor, but if that engine like stutters, then it could change the tempo of Erdogan's government going forward.
Did I hear him talking trash about their central bank, too, this week?
Oh, yeah. He also took direct aim at the independent monetary policy of the central bank, saying, like, why is this a taboo? I should be able to talk about it willy-nilly. And then the stock market reminded him of why that was a bad idea.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, it sounds a little familiar, like, you're saying, I mean, if he's not delivering economic prosperity, then what is he doing? Like, what is he getting them? And it, you know, it sounds a little bit like us here. That's the main reason. Well, I shouldn't say the main reason Trump was elected, but
among the reasons,
it's something people expect of him, even people who didn't vote for him, I think.
The Never Trump Republicans, who, you know, probably see, think he has some kind of business acumen, even though they don't necessarily agree with him for his tone or demeanor or personality or history or whatever, any other reasons. Appearance. Yeah. I mean, might as well throw that in too.
Yeah, I mean, we'll have to definitely look forward to look at Turkey coming up. I think it's also if their economy collapses, they are geopolitically
important.
A state that's really important. Have they been building ties to Russia, or are those long-standing ties?
Well, I mean, there's some ties just by degree of proximity. They've always been across the Black Sea from each other. But more recently, they purchased an air defense system, the S-300, from Russia, which might be causing some problems in NATO. But if they're having these kind of foreign exchange problems, you can understand why they might want to go with another source for military equipment instead of trying to buy dollars on the open market.
Is there any reason to believe Trump, I can't help it nowadays, that Russia would have been backing Erdogan?
He's been in government now for the better part of 2 decades, so he is the way that things are.
Anything else to look forward to?
Thanksgiving. I hope everybody has a wonderful Thanksgiving. Hold your family and friends close.
We're obliged to say what we're thankful for.
Obligatory thankfulness. I'm thankful that the institutions of government are still notionally standing and functioning.
Hey, that was mine. I'm thankful for friends, family, health, and that we're all still standing. I mean, honestly,
Good job, America. Let's hope for another good year.
As crazy as 2017 has been and has seemed to be, I honestly think it might be better than I thought it was going to be. And
right. Who knew absolute ineptitude and failure to do anything would have looked so great?
Yes, we could have never expected it. Let's definitely look forward to, politically speaking, 2018 is going to be exciting. We'll see how the rest of the year goes as well. But, all right. Well, it's been a great Tell Me What to Think episode. Thank you, Charles.
Thank you, Pete.
You can find us on Twitter. I'm at Bloated Nemesis. Charles is at Green Weird, which is green_WYRD. And this has been Tell Me What to Think. Today's rage. Destroy the myth that will break our chains. Break your chains.